Hi, podcast listeners. This is another chapter in the ongoing serialization of Fates vs. Death Sunrise Hotel, a full-length novel that takes place in the Fates vs. Death universe. We'll be doing one chapter every other week, free on the podcast, or if you want to listen to or read the whole thing now, you can go to www.fatesvsdeath.com and buy the complete novel. When you buy the paper version of the novel, you'll get access to the complete audiobook that you can download in MP3 format. Fates vs. Death Sunrise Hotel contains some pretty heavy subject matter, including some sexual violence, so these podcasts are intended for mature listeners only. Fates vs. Death Sunrise Hotel, a novel by Brian St. Clair Kane. This story takes place in the world of Fates vs. Death, the role-playing game. The day it happened. The cut on Tina's arm was throbbing, and it woke her up. She remembered that she hadn't really washed out the cut at all. She had just passed out and it had scabbed over during the night. Everyone was asleep. Tina limped around the tiny patch of floor space between furniture and yellow walls, testing her ankle. Walking hurt less today, but it was still painful. Tina figured it was too late for breakfast at any of the shelters, so she would just have to wait for lunch. Tina grew bored waiting for her roommates to wake up, so she took her homemade lockpick set and sat outside the room. The set was just a rake and tension bar, made from pieces of metal she had scavenged from busted pins. She sat on the hallway carpet and practiced trying to pick the lock to their room. The key was to turn the tension bar, putting pressure on the lock, and then rake the pins with the rake. When it worked, the tension caused the pins to stick at the right height, and if she could get all pins stuck all at once, the lock would turn. A fat old guy hobbled up the stairs. He carried two plastic grocery bags, which he set down by a door a few rooms down from Tina. When he got inside and was about to shut the door, he said, "I'm gonna call the police!" in a squeaky, effeminate voice. "Fuck you," Tina said. "I live here. I'm just practicing." The man shut the door. When she heard voices from inside the room, she went back inside. Tabitha and Joe were asleep. Marisol was lying on her couch, but with her eyes open. Manny was sitting up in bed, stroking Joe's shaven head with his fingertips and talking with Marisol. They stopped talking when Tina came in. Tina felt offended, but tried not to let it show. Tina told them about the guy she'd met on the subway who said he would buy her a drink in the Harlem Club. "We should go there tonight," Tina said. "He'd probably buy us all drinks." They said they probably would. Eventually, they all got up and the five of them headed out to St. Anne's in the Bowery for lunch. Tina was limping hard and was out of breath, but she managed to keep up with the others without leaning on anyone. When they got to St. Anne's, they were surprised to see no line. They went up to the door of the building and saw a note tacked to it. "Due to budget problems, we are suspending all meal services until further notice. Our apologies. Go with God." "Shit," Joe said. "Hey, if we hurry, maybe we can make it to the Islam Community Center in time for their lunch." Tina realized there was no way she could keep up. She told the others she was going to go see if she could panhandle enough money to buy herself lunch at a fast food place. She told them she would meet them at the hotel room later that afternoon so they could go get dinner and go hit the bar. Tina limped through the Bowery towards Broadway. She kept an eye out for anyone who looked like an addict or pusher. She worried that someone might see her limping and see her as a good target. When she saw someone, she stopped until they had left so they wouldn't see her limping. She also worried about the weather. Dark clouds were moving swiftly across the sky. It started shrinking before she even got to Broadway. By the time she had settled down into one of her usual panhandling spots, there was a steady rain. The rain was cold, propelled by a sharp wind, hitting her even under the overhang she was sitting under. She had to ask for money loudly to be heard over the patter of rain and the flapping of the overhang in the wind. People were not interested in stopping to dig through their pockets in the rain. A tall, broad-shouldered black man in a suit and tie stopped under Tina's overhang to smoke a cigarette. Tina got a cigarette from him, but he wouldn't give any money. The rain ceased, and Tina decided to get home. She hated to leave without having made a cent, but she knew this might be her only opportunity to go home without getting thoroughly soaked. She limped home, her feet splashing in little puddles on the concrete. There was a little Chucky's Del Taco on the way home, and she popped inside. She told the skinny Arabic girl at the counter that it was her birthday and asked if she could have a free taco. The girl said no in an exasperated tone. Tina tried to ask some of the other patrons if they would buy her food, but then a security guard came in and told Tina to leave. The hotel room was empty when Tina got there. She lay on the new mattress and stared up at the ceiling, thinking about how hungry she was. After about 10 minutes of that, she got up and ransacked the room, looking for any drugs that might have been left lying around. She kept thinking there might be a roach or a pain pill or a bottle of liquor with a little bit left in the bottom. She couldn't find anything. Tina sat on Marisol's couch and fingered the spiral wound on her arm. It was hot to the touch, and she could feel her own pulse beating through it. She squeezed it, getting a strange thrill out of causing herself pain. She decided to make a cool-looking scar and considered making a similar cut on her other arm. Tina wanted drugs. She was hungry and cold and in pain and bored and lonely and miserable. She looked out the window, getting up close so she could peer to the side and see a small bit of sidewalk and street. The dark rain clouds hid the sun, making it hard to tell what time it was. Tina considered whether she should wait for her roommates to come back or whether she should go out on her own. She decided to stay. Desperate for something to do, Tina got out her knives. On impulse, she stood up on the bed and started to carve graffiti in the ceiling. Old plaster fell on her face, and she blinked it out of her eyes. "I hate," she wrote. Then she wasn't sure what to write under it. She knew what she wanted to write, but she didn't know if she wanted other people reading it and seeing it came from her. She sat back down on the couch and stared at the two words. Then she got up and finished the sentence. "I hate me." After she wrote it, she got nervous. The others would call her a freak if they saw she had written that. So Tina got up on the bed and faced the other direction. This time she carved the words, "I hate you." Manny, Joe, and Marisol came back to the hotel room. Louis was with them. Louis was a friend of Marisol's, and Tina thought he had a crush on Marisol. He lived in a cheap hotel, like the Sunrise, that was a few blocks away. He was older than they were, in his 20s, and had pretensions of being an artist. He didn't act any more mature than they did, and he was always getting into trouble, mostly by getting into fights with other people in the neighborhood. Louis vacillated between claiming he had quit using drugs and doing amphetamines every night. He was tall and thin, with greasy curly brown hair and a big nose. He had an old black leather jacket with a tattered, burned Freedom Army flag sewn to the back. "Let's go," Tina said. "We better hit the mission soon if we want to get dinner." It was raining only lightly. By the time they got there, though, it was already too late. The other residents of their neighborhood must have heard about the St. Anne's closing and had reacted by all going extra early to the mission. The line was already around the corner, far more people than the mission could serve. They decided to go up to Harlem and try to meet up with the young man Tina had met in the subway. Manny and Joe had some money, so at the subway they paid one fare, squeezed in together, and gave Tina change to get herself in. Louis paid his fare and squeezed in with Marisol, which made Tina jealous. The subway station was cold and a constant wind came from the tunnel, but at least it was dry. Tina sat on a bench next to a pile of cigarette butts while the others stood around. It was raining when they got to Harlem, and they went to the bar as quickly as they could. The place was warm and packed with people, most of whom probably just came in to get out of the rain. A lot of the people in the bar were young Wells with mathematical symbols tattooed on their flesh and scrawled on their clothing. Tina knew they were math addicts. Tina looked for the guy she had met on the subway, but couldn't see him. She went to the back room. It reeked of smoke, and she saw two people playing pool blindfolded. A young man with green spiked hair would help direct the players to the cue ball and point the cue at it, but it gave them no other help. Tina didn't have to watch for long to realize that they were playing better blindfolded than Tina could with her eyes open. When she came back, Marisol was at the bar chatting, in a flirty way, with some Indian guy. Louis was in the corner listening to two women having conversation and nodding. Joe and Manny made their way over to her. The crowd was so loud that she had to turn her ear to them to hear what they were saying. They asked if she'd found her man. She said no, and they said they were going to go hit another club they knew that was in Hummingbird territory nearby. She asked if they could score anything for her. They asked if she had any money, and she shook her head no, sadly. They said they would try, and took off. Tina went to the opposite side of the bar from where Marisol was flirting. She nudged a young man sitting at the bar. "Aren't you going to buy me a drink?" she asked. He smiled and nodded his head no. She nudged another man, a tall black guy with a shaved head, and asked him the same question. He motioned for the bartender. The bartender was an older woman with gray hair and a crew cut, military surplus clothing, a missing arm, and noticeable facial hair. "Round for the lady," he said, motioning to Tina. Tina ordered a Bloody Mary, figuring this might be the closest she would get to a meal that day. To Tina's surprise, the man who bought the drink for her didn't seem very interested in talking to her, or even looking at her. Marisol put her hand on Tina's shoulder to get her attention. "I'm not feeling well," Marisol said in Tina's ear. "I'm going home." "You want me to go with you?" Tina asked. "No, don't bother." "I'm going to try to get some food to bring home," Tina said, then to make sure Marisol had been able to hear her. "Okay?" Marisol nodded yes, then left. Tina got the guy to buy her another drink. As she drank it, he scribbled a complex mathematical equation on a bar napkin. He passed it over to her. She passed it back to him, shaking her head no with a confused expression. Tina heard a commotion and saw that Louis had gotten into a fistfight with a young woman. Tina worried that she might be a math addict, and the other math addicts in the bar might gang up on him, but Tina couldn't see any mathematical symbols on the woman's skin, striped sweater, or black skirt. People had backed out of the way to give the two room as Louis and the woman circled each other. Louis was a lot quicker and more skillful than Tina had expected, but the woman he was fighting with was even better. She knocked him to the floor pretty quickly and went back to her friends. Tina helped Louis up and helped him out of the bar. She let him sit down with his back against the brick wall of the bar. It was raining lightly, but a fire escape overhead funneled the water to drip down on either side of them. Tina went into Lewis's pocket and got out his cigarettes. Tina lit up one for him and then one for herself. "What was that all about?" Tina asked. "Oh, nothing," Lewis said. "Just cruising for a bruising. Now that I got my bruising, I'll be fine." "You're a weird guy," Tina said. "Glad you noticed," he said with a smile, then smeared blood from his nose onto the back of his hand. They went to the subway. Lewis paid and they squeezed into the system together. "She was a friend of my ex," Lewis said out of nowhere, sitting across from each other on the subway car. Tina didn't respond. She was too busy watching the purist who stood at the end of the train, surveying the car like a king surveying his kingdom. The purist had a tight gray suit covering his whole body, but wore a helmet with a built-in gas mask. The gas mask obscured his mouth, so Tina couldn't see his expression, but she could see his eyes as he scanned the car. His posture was straight, and the gray suit showed that he was muscular. Tina knew one of her knives would be unable to pierce the gray suit, and he could probably beat up anyone on the train if he wanted to. From what she had heard about purists, Tina imagined he was thinking, "You people are all filth," which made Tina feel angry and anxious. As they approached the 57th Street stop, Tina said to Lewis, "I'm getting off here." "You're not going home?" Lewis asked, disappointed. "Gotta make some money," Tina explained. Tina walked over to the red light district. This part of town had once been where all the tourists went. She could still see the old faded signs for department stores, fancy restaurants, and playhouses. Their lights no longer shone, but some storefronts were open. Neon signs advertised adult books and live strippers, as well as normal signs for liquor, payday advance, and all-night pizza. This was one of the brightest parts of the city at night. The ground was still wet, and reflections of various colors of neon signs sparkled up from the puddles. The rain had stopped. The air was cold, but it smelled clean. There were a lot of people on the streets. There were many prostitutes, in absurdly little clothing, standing on corners and talking. There were men who were obviously Johns, stalking the street, examining each whore they passed. There were a few street preachers handing out pamphlets. Touts were stepping in front of pedestrians, trying to talk them into entering strip clubs. Other pedestrians, male and female, young and old, were walking more quickly, trying to get to the other side of the red light district without attracting the attention of a preacher, tout, or whore. The side streets were not as brightly lit, more yellow street lights and less neon, but there were a lot of prostitutes hanging out and Johns walking around. Tina found a stretch of sidewalk that nobody seemed to be using. She leaned back against a wall under a street light, watching the Johns come and go. Almost immediately, a prostitute across the street pulled a knife out and yelled, "Hey!" angrily. She was a tall Hispanic woman with dark skin and bleach blonde pageboy haircut. She wore cut-off blue jeans with big holes in them and half of a t-shirt. The woman stomped across the street towards Tina. "Hey, cunt, you wanna die?" she shouted. Tina pulled out first one knife, then another. "Yeah, I wanna die!" Tina screamed back, surprised by her own vehemence. "And I wanna take you with me, cumbag!" The woman stopped about 10 feet from Tina. "This is my block," she growled, "and I'm gonna come back with five of my friends and we're gonna kick your ass!" "Fuck you," Tina spat. "I'm the fucking Blade Queen. I'll kill you and all your fucking friends." The woman left, and as soon as she was out of sight, Tina took off, running around the corner. She walked a few blocks away and found another spot to wait for a John. Her first John of the night was a pudgy, 30-something guy with a beard and overalls. "Hey, sexy," Tina said, getting his attention. She watched his eyes as he looked her over. Tina's theory about Johns was this. If they look at you like, "She'll do for a quick fuck," then they're fine. But if they look at you like, "That's the one I've been looking for all night," then they're probably dangerous. "What do you want, sexy?" Tina asked. "Blowjob," the man said with forced confidence. "$5. "Come on, then," Tina said, and led him to a nearby recessed alcove. Tina could tell that others had used the alcove for the same purposes. The ground there was littered with used condoms, cigarette butts, broken bottles, and used-up disposable lighters. When it was over, she went back to the sidewalk, feeling the bills in her pocket. A few more of these, she thought, and she could bring home dinner and drugs for all her roommates. She tapped nervously on the wall with her fingers, wishing she had something to wash the taste out of her mouth. A pudgy, butch-looking woman in a black suit walked by. "Hey, baby," Tina called out. "You want to have some fun?" The woman slowed but did not stop. She smiled at Tina, showing white artificial fangs. "Come see me after you've gone through puberty, cutie." "Can I have a buck then?" Tina shouted at the woman's back as she walked off, but she didn't respond. Another John came along. He was an older white guy in a rumpled gray suit. Tina thought he was probably one of those corporate types who comes to the city on their days off for drugs and sex. He and Tina talked about getting a hotel room. He seemed disappointed that Tina didn't know where the closest hotel was, but Tina said they could find one easily. Then the man looked up the street and saw something, then said, "Look, forget it. Have a nice night." Then he hurried off. A man was walking up the sidewalk towards Tina. He had black leather pants and a tight blue shirt-sleeved shirt with a Hawaiian print. It was not much clothing for a cold night like this. He was a mixed race with spiky brown hair. He was tall, muscular, walking confidently. Tina wasn't sure what was going on, but this guy had scared the John, so Tina turned and started walking away. She looked back and saw that the guy had increased his pace. Tina broke out into a run. "Wait!" he yelled, calling after her. He quickly closed the distance between them and was right behind her. "I just want to talk," he said, putting his hand on her shoulder and gently pulling her to a stop. Tina stopped and spun around to face the man. "What the fuck do you want?" she demanded angrily, her hand on the handle of her knife in her coat. She noticed he had a silver pendant dangling from his neck with the male and female symbols interlocked, engraved in it. "Have you heard of the sexologists?" he asked. "Yeah," she said, not letting the harshness in her voice relent. "I heard of you guys." "Can I buy you something to eat? There's a nice diner near here." Tina was too hungry to say no to free food, and so they went to a little all-night diner. It was dimly lit. A tired old woman gave them a menu, which had the normal diner fare and a bunch of Greek stuff Tina had never heard of. Tina ordered the double cheeseburger, and the sexologist ordered the spanakopita. He talked to her calmly and warmly. He gave his name and asked hers. She made up a fake name, calling herself Laura. "The reason I wanted to talk to you," he said, "is, well, first, to let you know someone out here cares about you. I care about you." "You don't even know me," Tina said, refusing to smile. "I don't have to know you to like you. I can see that you have good in you. Everyone does. And so I love you. And I care about you. I don't want you to hurt yourself." Tina glanced down briefly to make sure the spiral cut on her arm was covered by the sleeve of her denim jacket. "Okay," Tina said. "That's nice, I guess, but what good does it do me?" "Laura, I want you to think about someone you really like. Now, if you saw him eating poison, only he thought it was normal food, wouldn't you try to stop him?"
"Yeah,"
Tina said. She thought she knew where he was going with this. "Well, when you have sex for money, you're poisoning yourself. You may not realize it now, but you're messing up your concept of yourself and of the opposite gender. If you keep doing it, you'll end up hating your body, hating sex, hating men, and hating yourself." The food arrived. Tina popped a few hot fries in her mouth and talked with her mouth full.
Whoa, I'm not doing this as a career choice. I'm not out here every night. I've just hit some hard times, and I need to make some cash. If you got a cash to give me, I'll go home and not give another blowjob."
He seemed to flinch a bit, probably because Tina had gone so quickly to asking for money.
"Laura," he said, then paused, looking at her face. "Let me guess. The first time you did this, you were really desperate. You didn't know where you were going to sleep or how you were going to get fed. You were probably high. You might have had an older man who was telling you what to do. And you thought, I'll only do this once. And you hated it. But afterwards you said to yourself, that wasn't as bad as I thought. And next time, maybe you weren't so desperate. You just knew it was a good way to make some money. And each time you've been less desperate, and you've been doing it more and more often. Am I right?"
Tina had the cheeseburger up to her mouth. She shrugged.
"It's because you're getting used to it, getting numb. The more you hate yourself, the easier it is to do this."
His words made Tina think of what she had carved into the ceiling of the room.
"But it isn't something you should get used to. The most horrible events in history happened because people got used to things. They got used to killing, they got used to being enslaved. Just because you don't feel the pain as much doesn't mean that what's happening to you is any less horrible."
"So what am I supposed to do for money instead? Who's going to pay me for not having sex? Are you?"
"I can't give you money, Laura, but I can find you a place you could live."
"I got a place," Tina said, the food in her mouth slurring her speech. "I live with some people."
"And I bet they're sex workers too, aren't they?"
"We're runaways. We can't go home. We can't get real jobs. So we panhandle and scrounge up money however we can."
"That sounds like a way to survive. But what are your goals? What are you going to do with your life when you turn 18 and you can get welfare or a real job?"
She looked at him, stared into his eyes as he stared into hers. His eyes were soft, compassionate, unblinking. His pupils were large, like someone infatuated. She was embarrassed that she didn't know the answer to his question, so she lied. "I'm going to save up money and get the math enhancer program put in my head. I'm going to be a math addict."
He leaned back. "Well, you know, the math addicts are okay, some of them anyway. You could do a lot worse. And you're not going to get there unless you stop having sex for money. It's a pit, Laura, a trap. The more you sell yourself, then the more you hate yourself, the more you let your life fall apart, and the more desperate you are, the more horrible things you do for money. It just gets worse and worse, unless you put a stop to it."
Tina didn't answer. She asked the waiter to bring her over another order of fries.
"Laura, have you ever been sexually exploited as a child?"
"Not that it's really any of your business, but no."
"I bet a lot of your friends have."
"I don't ask shit like that."
"Maybe you should, Laura. I think if you'd asked, you'd be surprised how many of them have been abused. Then you'd know what the sex industry is really all about, the worldview that's behind it. Sexual exploitation, it steals people's childhood away. I think that's why the orphans are so devoted to protecting children, because they never got to live their own childhood, and they want to help someone else do it. Tina thought about how Maricel, who was the youngest of all of them, always acted the most mature, the most grown-up. Tina had always assumed that Maricel was born with some strength of character that the rest of them lacked. Maybe, instead, something bad had forced her to stop being a child, to grow up in a hurry. Maybe she'd had her childhood stolen. Tina didn't like that thought.
They ate and talked more, and Tina stuffed fries in her pocket whenever he looked the other way. Tina thought about asking him to meet her tomorrow. Maybe he would buy her dinner again. Then he said, "At least you're having sex with men." "Hmm?" Tina said, trying not to betray her surprise. "If you were male and a sex worker, then you'd be having sex almost exclusively with men, and that's twice as bad. Even if you don't consider yourself gay, if you spend enough time with people who think that is sex, you'll start to believe it." "What is it, if it isn't sex?" "It's gender hatred, Laura. Homosexual sex happens when people are so blind at the godhood in the opposite gender that they can only turn to their own gender for sex. It's not sex, though. You won't find what you're looking for that way any more than you'd find it having sex with a machine." Tina didn't say anything, but inside she was cursing herself for trusting this homophobic asshole. For starting to buy into his bullshit, she started stuffing fries into her pockets more quickly, not caring if he saw. "Look," she said, "I've got to get home or my roommates will be worried." "All right, Laura," he said. "Let me give you my phone address. You could give me a call sometime, and we could get together and talk more, okay?" "Yeah," Tina said, "okay." He gave her a slip of paper with his phone address on it, which she stuffed in her pocket. She hurried out of the restaurant before he could even pay the bill. She found another spot to wait for John's. There was a middle-aged black guy wearing a blue jumpsuit. He gave her $8. She sucked him off in an alley while he said obscene things. She finished him off with her hands, but he didn't complain. Then there was an old white guy with a cane. He was the easiest. $10 and she jacked him off in the shell of an old abandoned car. He didn't even have to take his pants off. They were loose enough that she could just stick her hand in and do it. He even thanked her afterwards. Tina went to a liquor store and got a beer, which she drank quickly. She met another suit and tie guy. This one was a big guy, tall, with a big belly. He was multiracial, with olive skin and big hands. He wanted to take her to a hotel. She said he could get sex and a blowjob for $40, and he had to pay up front and use a condom. He agreed. He told her his hotel and room number and told her to meet him there. It was a reasonable precaution, Tina knew, since he could get in trouble if he got caught by sexologists or night shift walking down the street with a prostitute. He took off and she went a different route. He was staying in one of those huge luxury hotels a few blocks north, near the park. They used to be really grand places that charged hundreds or thousands a night for their rooms. Today, the owners could only afford to keep the first few floors active. Yet they were still some of the nicest places to stay in the city, and when people with money were staying in the city, they could be found at these hotels. Tina passed through a large revolving door and into a large lobby with a layer of dust on the marble floor. The ceiling was high above her and had a painting of clouds and angels on it. There was an ornate wooden counter with a check-in sign hanging over it. A young man sat at the counter, leaning back in a chair and playing a game on a handheld computer. He looked to be Indian and wore an overlarge sweater and black jeans. He didn't look up at Tina as she passed through the lobby. There was an out-of-order sign on the elevator, so she had to limp up the stairs. She knocked at the door and the suit and tie guy let her in. The room was large, with a king-size bed and a large computer screen on the wall. The room smelled musty, and the carpet had various stains on it. The curtains were drawn, but Tina imagined she could see the park if she peeked past them. She had only passed by the park on either side, and had not seen it from above. Tina looked around the room carefully, looking for any signs that anyone else was hiding in the room. Tina got her money from the man and put it in the pocket of her denim jacket. Then she reminded him, "Remember, this is just for you on top and a blowjob. You want to do anything different, anything at all, it's going to cost you more. Got it?" He agreed as she got naked. He wanted the blowjob first, and Tina tried to finish him off as quickly as possible, but he didn't let her finish. He got on top and started fucking her. He grabbed her tits and started to squeeze hard, painfully hard. She told him to stop, but he ignored her. He just kept going. He started hissing at her, "Bitch, fucking bitch, dirty whore," as he fucked. She had kept careful track of where her weapons were from the moment she came in the room. The easiest to reach knife was in her jacket, lying on a nightstand within arm's reach. She could grab it easily. And it was not in a sheath. She could just grab it, jacket and all, and stab him right through the jacket. It wasn't a poison knife, and it might not kill him right away, but would make him stop the fucking and the squeezing and the ugly words. Or she could just let him finish. He had to be close to being done. And then it would stop, and she could get out of there, and if he tried anything else, she would stab him. Tina had kicked and thrown knives at those guys at the Columbia campus, but had never actually held a knife in her hand and plunged it into someone's body. What if she wasn't strong enough to do it? What if it didn't kill him? What if it only made him mad? What if he hit her, choked her, killed her? Tina was still in the throes of indecision when he came inside her. She pushed him off and quickly started getting dressed. She tried not to look at him. She didn't want to see his face, didn't want to see him look happy or satisfied or pleased with himself. She kept track of him out of the corner of her eye, making sure he stayed on the bed. If he comes anywhere near me, she thought, I'll stab him. Tina was shaking as she headed down the stairs. She didn't know if she was shaking with rage or fear. She didn't know what to think, but she did know she wanted to get someplace where she could be alone in case she lost it. She left the hotel and started walking east on the darkest street she could find, where all the street lights were burned out. If anyone saw her, she would be nothing more than a slightly limping silhouette. Tina fingered the wad of money in her pocket, counting in her head. She had 63 bucks in her pocket. Her breasts still ached. They would probably have nasty-looking bruises. She could put 20 towards rent, keep 5 for the future, spend 3 on some food for Maricel, and still have 35 for buying drugs. If she was thrifty, she could get enough drugs to get them all nice and fucked up that night. As she walked, she cursed herself, beat against her thighs with her fists. Why hadn't she killed that guy? What good was all the time she put into collecting knives, training with them, poisoning them, and rehearsing knife-fighting strategies in her mind if she wasn't going to stab a fucker like that? She used to think the knives meant she would never be a victim, but here she was, a fucking victim. Eventually, her mind turned from her perceived failure with the John to drugs. The problem with drugs is finding a dealer. Black market traders have good prices and act sanely, but they seldom have what you want. Drug lord pushers are violent and unpredictable, and always trying to force or trick you into using the drug lord's ultra-addictive shit. Goods always have what you want, and they never try to fuck you over. But goods are incredibly hard to find. Even if you were lucky enough to get the pager address of a good, chances are he would be too busy to deal with you. And Tina's ankle still hurt, which meant she wouldn't be willing to walk all over the damn city looking for a good dealer. Maybe she could go home and get one of her roommates to get the drugs. They wouldn't complain about her being lazy then, not if she was giving them good money for drugs. Then she could just sit back, rest her feet, hang out with Maricel, and wait for the at-home drug delivery. Tina wondered if the sexologist was right, if she was getting used to having people do things to her. When she first came to the city, would she have let some guy hurt her like that? Of course she would have. She would have thanked the guy and asked him to take her home with him. When she first came to the city, she was scared and ignorant. She didn't know how she was going to survive, or if she could survive. She didn't know that she would find friends that she could get a hotel room with. She didn't know that a not unattractive girl could make enough money panhandling to survive. She spat angrily on the ground. This is stupid, she thought. What did he really do to her? Hurt her a little? She'd already hurt herself worse than that twice in the last week. He didn't kill her. He didn't take anything from her. If he'd done anything really bad, she would have stabbed him in the neck. As it was, she got some slightly bruised tits and 40 bucks. It wasn't how she preferred to spend her time, but it wasn't some big fucking tragedy. Tina refused to be one of those whiny bitches who acted like some guy had ruined their lives. No stupid suit-wearing asshole had the power to ruin Tina's life, she decided, or even make her feel bad for more than a few minutes. A cold, damp wind was coming off the East River and bit into every exposed bit of skin. Tina noticed she was slouching and straightened up. Tina decided that starting now, she was going to feel good. She had 63 bucks in her pocket, she was going home, and she was going to enjoy herself. Tina paid her own subway fare so she wouldn't have to squeeze in with anyone. It was mostly weirdos out at this hour, very few people she'd want to squeeze in with. On her way home, Tina hit a dirty little fast food place and picked up some food she thought Maricel might like. It was fairly dark in the Bowery as she limped towards her hotel. Only about 1 in 5 streetlights was functioning, and the moon was behind thick clouds, meaning the whole neighborhood was islands of light in a sea of darkness. Luckily, the neighborhood was also quiet, and Tina listened carefully as she walked for any sounds of anyone in the shadows trying to sneak up behind her. She stayed away from any of the broken-down cars or garbage piles or corners of buildings where someone might hide and jump out from. When she arrived at the hotel, the first thing she noticed was blood. It was pooled up on the sidewalk in front of the hotel, and there were drops of it leading through the door. She got out a knife and went to the door of the hotel, peering in through the small window in the door. The stairs were dimly lit, but bright enough for her to see nobody was on them. Quickly, she pulled the key out of her pocket and opened the door. She slipped inside. Everything was quiet. Tina limped her way carefully up the stairs to the lobby. Little splotches of dark blood on the carpet made a trail through the lobby, into the hallway, and turning at the stairs. Tina listened and heard the distant sounds of radios and people talking, nothing out of the ordinary for the hotel this time of night. Tina crept into the stairwell and saw the blood heading up the stairs. She went as quickly as she could, following the blood up to the third floor, her floor, where the trail led into her hallway. Tina's heart was racing. The hallway was empty. Tina tried to form a strategy in case someone leapt out of one of the doors and tried to attack her. Should she head up the stairs or down? If she headed up, she would have a higher ground advantage and would find it easier to kick people who chased her. On the other hand, going up meant she would be trapped, unless she could get out onto one of the fire exits at the end of each hallway.
Tina could see the blood heading down her hallway, but it disappeared in the dim distance, and she could not see where it led. The hallway was silent and still as she crept quietly down it. There were bloody handprints on the wall, as if someone was stumbling down the hallway, putting their hand on the wall occasionally for support. As she approached her room, she could see the door was open. Light on the hallway carpet told her the light in the room was on. The blood trail turned into her room. Tina crouched down, keeping her side pressed firmly against the wall of the hallway. She put her knife on the ground and slid it towards the open doorway, then slowly tilted it upward so she could reflect the contents of the room. In the warped, blurry reflections of the knife, the room looked empty. Tina withdrew her knife, stood up, and peered slowly into the room. There was nothing in the tiny room that could possibly hide a person, so it only took a glance to confirm that the room was empty. Tina entered and quickly closed and locked the door behind her. There was a large pool of blood in the middle of the room, and droplets on Maricel's couch and the wall above it. Tina touched the pool of blood. It was wet, but room temperature. So, at least a few minutes had passed. Tina checked her various knives hidden around the room. They were all intact and clean. So who had been injured, and how, and where did they go? Maybe, Tina thought hopefully, Tabitha had slit her wrists. And then where had she gone? Had someone picked her up? Perhaps to take her to a hospital? They didn't even have a phone, so how could Tabitha have summoned help? Tina went and checked the bathroom, hoping one of her roomies might be hiding there, but it was empty. The more she thought about it, the less suicide seemed plausible. This was an act of violence. It was more blood than a broken nose, and there weren't any bullet holes anywhere, so most likely someone had been cut. Were they cut outside? Then did they come in the room? In which case, why wasn't the person still in the room? It made more sense that something had happened in the room, someone got hurt, and then that person went downstairs and was picked up there. She checked the door. It didn't look like it had been forced. Tina decided it was too dangerous to wait in the room. She went outside and went around the corner, where she could watch the entrance to the hotel from a dark spot with no streetlight burning overhead. Her ankle hurt too much for her to stand, so she sat down on the cold concrete. It started to rain lightly, and she slowly got soaked. She kept the bag of fast food under her jacket, trying to keep it from getting wet. At first, its residual warmth felt pleasant against her skin, but soon it was just a squishy lump. She thought about eating it, but realized she was too nervous to eat. She was shivering, her teeth chattering, when she saw Manny and Joe approach the hotel. Manny and Joe were stumbling, obviously drunk. When they saw Tina limping as fast as she could toward them, though, they quickly realized something was wrong. Tina explained what she had seen, and they quickly hurried up the stairs to see for themselves. Tina followed close behind them. Manny and Joe asked pretty much the same questions Tina had asked herself. Tina offered her own guesses. There had to have been one of us involved, and since it wasn't me and it wasn't you guys, it had to be Maricel or Tabitha. Both, Manny said. What if they got into a fight? Tina doubted that. Tabitha backed down from fights, and Maricel was too even-tempered to get into them. They sat around and waited, asking the same questions again and again until Tina was sick of them. Then Tabitha came home, looking confused and frightened, asking what all the blood was from. Tina felt her hope disappearing, making her feel cold and dizzy. Something had happened to Maricel. Tina worked it over in her mind as Manny and Joe explained their ignorance to Tabitha. It made sense that Maricel had been the one involved. She had said she wasn't feeling well and was heading home. She had been here. Someone had come to the door. It had to be someone Maricel knew because Maricel let the person in. Or maybe it was a good lockpicker. Then, when they were both in the room, something happened. Someone got stabbed. Probably in the gut, given how steady the bleeding was. Then the wounded person went downstairs and got picked up by someone. If Maricel had been the one doing the stabbing, then why hadn't she come back to the room? If she had stabbed someone in self-defense, it seemed that she should be there now, which meant that Maricel had probably been the one who had been stabbed. And she either ran downstairs to escape or was carried downstairs by her attacker. Either way, someone grabbed her downstairs. Was she alive or dead? Where had she been taken? Guys, Tina said, we've got to ask the neighbors. Find out what they heard. Someone had to have heard something. We have to find out. They sat, as if thinking about whether that was the right thing to do, but then Tina hit them with an angry, dangerous look, and they mumbled assent. Like the other buildings in the neighborhood, the Sunrise Hotel building was very thin, very deep, and 6 stories tall. A long hallway with tiny rooms on either side stretched from the front of the building to the back of it. There were 6 rooms and a stairwell on their side of the hallway, and 8 on the opposite side. Their 5 closest neighbors and the 2 rooms on either side of them, the room directly across from them, and the 2 rooms flanking it. Tina had seen people coming and going from rooms, but had never bothered to keep track of who lived where. New people seemed to show up at the hotel every week. Many of the people who lived here were homeless people who lived in rooms here when they had some money and lived on the streets the rest of the time. Tina went to the room right across the hall and banged on it. She thought about who might be there, and she got the impression it might be a middle-aged guy with a beard and a sour face. As she knocked, Joe, Manny, and Tabitha knocked on other doors around her. "Hello?" Tina shouted into the door. "I need to talk to you. Something happened to my roommate, and I need to know if you heard anything." She waited a few moments. Manny was talking through the door to someone in the room to their left. Tina was about to go over and join in the conversation when she saw a piece of paper slide under the door. It was a page torn from a book, covered with dense printing on two columns. Tina picked it up and recognized it as a passage from the Bible. She flipped it over but found no notes, nothing to indicate any sort of message. "What the fuck is this?" Tina shouted. "Hey, talk to me. This doesn't mean anything to me. I don't know what this means." She waited but didn't get any response. She looked at the page, wondering if it was some cryptic message. Skimming over the text, the first side talked about someone warning someone that someone else wanted him dead, and then someone was whining about how much Jerusalem sucks, and Jesus healing someone, and part about where people should sit at a dinner table. On the other side, there was some stuff about people getting invited to dinner, and flavorless salt, and someone finding lost sheep, and someone finding lost coins, and a little bit of something about some son talking to his father about how money should be divided. "I don't understand this," Tina said and pounded on the door. "I don't know anything about the Bible. You probably know a lot about the Bible. Why don't you teach me? Why don't you tell me what this means?" She waited and there was no response. "I'll stay out here pounding on your door all night until you come talk to me," she said and pounded on the door with both fists. Manny came and put his hand on her shoulder. She stopped pounding. "I talked to the woman who lives over there. She said that a few hours ago she heard knocking and a male voice saying something about money and calling the police. And then a couple minutes later there was some shouting and screaming." "She didn't see who?" "No, she didn't open her door. And all she heard was something about money and calling the police? She said she thought the guy might have said something like, 'Come with me.'" "Is that it?" "Yeah." "Okay, go knock on some more doors." Tina pounded on the door for a while more. Her arms were getting tired, so she sat down on the floor and repeatedly kicked the door with her heel. The others had not had any more luck. Tina told them she wanted to go to the hospital. She wanted Manny and Joe to go with her and Tabitha to stay in case, by some miracle, Marisol came back. Tabitha refused to stay there by herself, so they decided Tina and Joe would go to the hospital while Manny and Tabitha stayed behind. They paid for the subway, squeezing in together. They didn't know what time it was, but there weren't any gang members out, so it was probably past 2 a.m. Homeless people were sleeping on the subway. In the car with them was a very short older woman, who looked like she might be Pacific Islander. She wore armor made of old magazines and phone books duct taped together with shards of glass poking out from between the pages. She was hunched over, saying some endless litany to herself. The ER waiting room was full of people. Most of them were sitting in the hard plastic seats, which were all bolted to the floor. Some were sick, some were bleeding. There were a lot of pale, wide-eyed people. They wore clothing that wasn't fashionable and didn't fit very well, but were too new to have been bought in the thrift store or scrounged from the trash. Tina figured they must be shut-ins, VR addicts mostly, the city's invisible majority, who had all their groceries delivered and who tried never to leave their apartments. It made sense. If they only left their homes for emergencies, this was where they would end up when they did. There was a bulletproof glass window with a woman in a nurse's uniform behind it. There was a line of several people waiting to talk to her. Tina and Joe got in line. After about 15 minutes, they got to the front. The woman looked like she was in her 40s. She had a bald head with thick black lightning bolt tattoos on it, and similar tattoos on the exposed portions of her neck and wrists. She had a tired look on her face. She put an old clipboard with a form on it into a pass-through box. She shut the door to the box and pushed, and a little door opened on their side to give them access to the clipboard. "Which one of you is sick?" she asked. "My friend, Marisol," Tina started nervously. I don't know if she's in here or not. She was hurt a couple hours ago, and she might have come in here. She was young, Caucasian, looked kind of like me. She had brown hair, and..." Tina couldn't think of much else. "Yeah, we had someone like that come in here. Had the hell beat out of her." "What's her name, Marisol?" "Don't know her name, honey. You family?" "Yeah," Tina said. "I'm her sister." "You know anything about her medical history? Any previous illness? Any allergies?" Tina shook her head. "What's your name?" "Tina," she said. "Monroe." "You have ID?" Tina shook her head no. "Okay. Look, I'll see if there's someone who can take you back there to see her. But I need you to be patient and wait. I've got people with real problems who need to use this window." Tina stood and stared. "Next!" the nurse called, and a big guy with his arm wrapped up in bloody rags pushed past her. It was getting light out when someone came out of the heavy door and called Tina's name. Joe tried to come with Tina, but the man would only let Tina in. "Are you her doctor?" Tina asked.
"No, I am just medical assistant," said the young man in a heavy Asian accent.
He led her down a large room. On either side of the room, stained blue curtains separated tall hospital beds. There were countless IVs and machines on stands and wheels, hooked up to people. All of the machines were plugged into the wall, and most were beeping. On some beds, blankets covered still human shapes. Some of the blankets were stained all over with blood. On the walls, small white plastic boxes let out occasional bursts of mist. There was a chemical smell to the whole place that brought up bad memories from Tina's past, making her shudder. There was also a strong smell of unwashed homeless people, who Tina assumed made up a large portion of the patients. The young man opened the curtain at a bed and let Tina through.
"You'll have visitor," he pronounced loudly.
The first thing Tina saw was a face that was a swollen mass of puffy red flesh and seeping cuts. There were blood-soaked gauze bandages over some of the cuts. The face had been dabbed with some brown liquid. The figure had a hospital gown on and was under a blanket. There were blossoms of blood at various places on the sheets. An old faded monitor attached to the bed showed a graph of various colored lines moving up and down as time progressed. It took Tina a minute to realize this was not Maricel. By then, the young medical assistant had left.
"I'm sorry," Tina said. "You're the wrong person."
"Late,"
the injured woman slurred.
"Late, yeah, to tell my people who did this to me so they could get revenge."
"I'm sorry," Tina said. "I don't have time to get involved."
"Wait,"
the woman moaned, but Tina walked hurriedly out. She tried to find the medical assistant, asked him if there were any other Caucasian women who had come in recently. She couldn't find him, though. She tried to ask other people, but they ignored her. Eventually, she went back through the door she had come in. Joe said, "Oh," in a cold, tired voice when she explained that it was not the right person. Tina was too exhausted and her ankle hurt too much to do anything else. It was fully morning before they got back to the hotel. Tabitha was already asleep on Maricel's couch. Tina pushed her way into bed next to Joe and Manny. She had a sick feeling in her stomach as she fell asleep.